Yeah, but I couldn't. I understand that there was lots of fire the previous 2 days. I hope to bring you some fires as well now. As you can see, I came from the Department of Mechanical Engineering, and I basically I'm doing studies on fire behavior. I nevertheless put together some. Sorry. I'll speak basically on fire behavior modeling, but I put a couple of topics on meteorological fire danger index and on fuel characterization, because I saw that there were several talks on this topic as well. As all of us we know, forest fires are a very complex phenomena that depend on many factors, some of them of socioeconomic nature, but also, and in my opinion, mainly on physical factors. It is difficult and dangerous to analyze only parts of this problem. They should be considered as a whole, although they are composed by multiple and interacting systems. So my experience during these about 20 years of research in this field is that we need to talk to each other, to look at different perspectives, at different disciplines. And I find it very interesting that statisticians and mathematicians are also getting interested in this very challenging topic. I've been trying to investigate on fire behavior, and I'm going to mention some things that we did in the past. Our approach, our methodology, is we are carrying analytic studies. We are doing some numerical modeling, mainly on physical aspects, heat transfer, fluid mechanics, and so on. We are doing experimental studies, both in the laboratory and in the field. We are observing real fires and also doing case studies. Case studies we do especially for accidents, fatalities. This is one of the motivation of our research from the beginning, and we unfortunately have to do some of those investigations. We have a fire lab in central Portugal, inside which we have different devices. This is a combustion tunnel. This is one of our slope tables. This is a sort of a canyon table that we built recently. And I'm sorry, this is a picture of our field, experimental field, where we do normally every year different experiments, not only related to fire behavior, but also all sorts of things, fire ecology, smoke dispersion, suppression, retardant testings, and all that. This is generally included in European supported projects, and scientists from all over Europe come here to attend these experiments. Usually they are carried out during 3 or 4 days, and we can have around 100 researchers there. We also go to real fires. This is a vehicle that we equipped with the image and the data transmission things, and these are pictures that this car has seen in the past years. Okay, about meteorological fire danger index. This is one very fundamental component of every forest fire management system. I think every country that has a problem with forest fires should have a meteorological fire danger system. And even so, I find that some countries don't have it. And one thing we realize is that there are many methods to estimate fire danger based on meteorological parameters. This is just a list of some that we have been looking at or we have been studying. As you can see, many of them carry the names of the people that created them, because they are not much more than variants to around the same thing. And I apologize, this table is in Portuguese, but it gives you an idea about the types, different parameters that can be used in different methods. Some requires some and others other parameters, so this makes them more meaningful or more easy to use or whatsoever. Some years ago, in a European project, we started a challenge of comparing the different methods. The methods that were being used in these four European countries, and we also picked the Canadian Fair Weather Index. It happens that the only one that is in this list that is Spanish is a non-cumulative. It takes only the daily values. And we found that this really works not good. And perhaps this is related to the previous lecture, that not a very good result was found, including danger index, because this index performs very badly. We picked data from different regions around these three countries of Europe, and we applied the same methods to the same data of different countries. We did some normalization of the indexes, and for example, for a particular country, for a given set of years, this is the output from different methods. As you can see here, the Canadian system performs quite well here. This is the number of daily fires as a normalized value of the index. This is the average area burned daily, and again, the Canadian system performs well. And some others perform very badly in all. This is another parameter, average size of a fire. From these figures, we could get some idea, but it's let's say to have a more objective assessment, we did some statistical analysis, and for a very simple one, considering, for example, the whole set of data, we divided in two complementary sets, and we took the average of a given index in each one of these sets, and this is the standard deviation of that index for the entire population. For example, one criteria could be days in which the burned surface was more than 1,000 hectares, or could be days with fires, and the other set would be days without fires, whatsoever. These are different criteria. And comparing these two parameters, this distance, it is an objective criteria to distinguish different indices applied to the same population, and the result was generally this one. We dealt with winter fires and also with summer fires, and almost always the fire weather index performed better than all the others. And as a result of this study, this was in 92, we made the recommendation to the European Commission to adopt the fire weather index Canadian system as a standard for Europe, and this has been effective. And all the southern countries of Europe use this, and we, the research community in Europe, we use the Canadian system as a standard. You know it quite well. There have been a lecture on this, so I don't go on that. I think this is not the end of the line, because there is still some research needed, because we find that the fire weather index is very well correlated with the days of fires, with number of fires, with the burnt surface. But it alone does not pick the extreme fire days. We need to mix more other criteria to pick up the extreme fire days. We are now working on that. Of course, the Canadian fire weather index must be calibrated for each country. And in our country, we did it for each region or each district. We have these five classes. We set that we should have around 40 to 60% of the days with the low class, and 80% with moderate or less, and not only 2 to 3% of the days should be extreme. And this criteria sets different standards in different regions. I'll not go in detail on this, because my main purpose is the second part of my talk. So I'll just give a brief. For example, this is the probability that the fire weather index, this number of fires is zero in the district of Coimbra. In this case, it's about 30%. Of having one fire or less is 40%, and so on. So the maximum number of fires for Coimbra you should read here is about 40 fires per day in this period of time. And the same applies for the burned surface and for the fire weather index values. So this is maximum value that was measured daily in the entire period. Fire weather index and the area should be read in this right side of the figure. And applying the previous criteria and looking at these three parameters, fire weather index, number of fires and burned surface, we set these limits for each class. And these are two other districts, and we, using the same methodology, we set out these limits. As you can see, they are different. And also, for example, the extreme class means different things in different districts. For example, in this district, extreme day can be with 10 fires or more. In this district can be 170, 200, and also the burn surface can be different. This we did for the whole country. As these values are a bit, let's say, arbitrary, we rounded them because in 15 or 16, it doesn't make lots of difference. And this is the table for the 18 districts of Portugal for the summer months. There is a different calibration for winter time, which has only three classes. The Canadian system gives other outputs that are of interest. For example, the draft code is a very good indicator of the fire season, because it depends very much on the precipitation. It gives an amount of water in the soil, so we can see that this is a particular year in which there was lots of rain and very little fires. These are normal years. These are very bad years. And from this, we can see how the season is going on. For you to get an idea about the importance of the draft index, these points are the average values for the period of June to September for Coimbra, for one point in Portugal. And they are correlated here with the total surface burned in Portugal for these years. As you can see, dry years that tend to have higher draft code burn more, and the contrary. So there is a strong correlation with this. Another point I'd like to mention about the fuel characterization. I suppose you are aware that the fine fuel moisture content is a very important parameter, especially when we speak about dead fine fuels. This is a table that we have in our lab where we measure the rate of spread of a fire front in a horizontal fuel bed. And for pine needles, Pinus pinacea, we find this relationship with the moisture content. For example, if the moisture content is above a certain value, there is no spread, and this range is practically flat, and if it goes very low, it increases the rate of spread. So it's very important to be able to predict that fine fuel moisture content, especially in this range. It's not so important here. And the concept of moisture of extinction is also very not, let's say, very a precise thing. It's more stochastic because it depends on many other factors, namely if there is wind or what is the arrangement of the fuels. So it's not considered here. For you to have an important idea about the importance of this fuel moisture content, you can see here for a set of years the relationship between the moisture content and the average area that burned in the days in which we had moisture content in these different ranges. The similarity between this curve and the previous one is immediate. Also, if we take the average value of the Pinus pinacea moisture content for the fire season, for the months of June to September, you can also see a good correlation between the burned surface in the country and this. So, years in which the average value of the moisture content is lower have burned more, and the contrary. And here I'm making relationship between the measurements that are made actually at one point in the country with the whole surface of the country. We take samples of different fuels, and normally during the year we do sampling every week, once a week, and during summer we try to make every day. So these are six different fuel types, for 2003, and we have this data bank since 87. It's important to estimate the moisture content of dead fuels, and again, the Canadian system gives an output that is fine fuel moisture code that is well correlated with this moisture content and is a good estimator of this parameter. Now I go to fire behavior modeling. I suppose all of us are aware that there are mainly four fire spread regimes: ground fire, surface fire, ground fire, and spot fire. These are the most important, and the most studies are done on surface fires. The other ones are, let's say, very tricky, and again, lots of stochastic processes happen here, and they are less well understood. I'm going to speak a bit about surface fires. And my research has been to look at wind and slope effects that are, let's say, the main factors on this, and I'm going to talk about a particular type of behavior of a fire that I call eruptive fire behavior. We are used to to consider that the properties of a fire change when some of these three factors change, either topography, fuel, or meteorology. What I'll try to show you is that perhaps we should consider a fourth element on that polygon, that is the parameter time. Because we have found that even when these things are, let's say, stable, they do not change, they are uniform, the fire properties change with time. So that's why I'm proposing to have a square instead of a triangle, and I'll try to show it in a moment. So it's recognized that wind and slope are some of the major factors affecting fire behavior. And they affect namely because of the convection that is induced by the fire and that is modified either by slope or by wind or by both. And quite often, the role of this natural convection is not considered in the fire behavior models. And in particular, wind is very difficult to predict, as you know. In fire behavior modeling, it's very common to make assumptions like this. Even if they are not explicit, they are implicit in the models, at least in when they were, let's say, started, when they were developed, there were some types of assumptions like these. The fire line essentially is a straight line without curvature, or at least with a very large radius of curvature compared with the size of the flame. The full bed is assumed to be homogeneous and with a single layer. Terrain normally it's flat, without curvature, without convex or concave features. The wind field is quite often considered to be uniform over the entire domain, at least in the section that you are studying. And the boundary conditions are assumed to be permanent if in relation to time. One thing that we should be aware that when we are dealing with the problem of forest fires, we are dealing with space and time scales that range for orders of magnitude. And here I'm considering only one linear dimension. If you are considering a particle, it's something of size of a millimeter of that order, and different sections, different parts of the fire. For example, a large fire can have hundreds of meters, kilometers, or even tens of kilometers. And also in the time scale, we can have events that take some seconds, some tens of seconds, minutes, hours, or even days. So it's very difficult to cope with all these orders of magnitude in a single model, in a single computer system. So if you want to build a three-dimensional system that goes from the chemistry at the particle and predicts a large fire, it's, at the present stage, is very difficult. So it's very common to separate this problem in at least these two ends. What I call a local range that copes with the problems in the combustion zone and the section of the fire, and the global range that looks at the perimeter of the fire and tries to predict how the fire will evolve. Of course, for this scheme to work, they must have some overlapping. They, of course, they overlap here, at the properties of the fire at the section of the fire front. And most models look, try to understand what happens at the section of the fire front. And from there, they jump upward. This picture that is taken from a paper report by Rottermel in 83 illustrates what I am saying. For example, if this is the perimeter of the fire at a given time, if we know the properties of fire at each point of the fire front of the perimeter, for example, in this case, he assumes that this is the slope effect, this is the wind effect, this is the combination of two. In 1 hour, next hour, the fire will be, in 4 hours, the fire will be at that location. And doing this at all points, it is assumed that we can predict the fire. One assumption that is made here is that each point of the fire front acts on its own. There is no interaction between points. So if we know the properties of the fire at each section of the fire front, we can estimate what will be happening next. But this is not true, because what happens is that neighboring points of the fire front interact with each other and modify the local properties, as we'll see. So if we stick with the local problem with the section of the fire and dealing with slope and wind, you can have these situations. The simplest case is when there is no slope, so horizontal full bed, no wind. I call this the basic problem. So if we want to start with something, this is the easiest thing that we can do. Then we can put either slope or wind, but parallel to the rate of spread. I call this complete because it includes slope and wind. But we can have also slope or wind that is not parallel to the rate of spread. I call this a general problem. And we can have both slope and wind and with arbitrary directions. I call this the complex problem. So we should look at these different things. The complete problem is this one, in which either slope or wind is parallel to the rate of spread. One thing that we found is that this problem has not a unique solution. We are used to accept that there is a single solution for this problem, and this is equivalent to assume that there is a steady state of fire spread. And we found that even in the very controlled conditions of laboratory experiments, we do not find this steady state. Rottermel in 72 published a report that gives an algorithm to estimate the rate of spread for horizontal full bed without wind, what I call the basic rate of spread. And this is based on these parameters that are mainly properties of the full bed. I'll not go into details on this. Then he considers that if there is wind or slope parallel to the rate of spread, you must multiply this by a function. And this function is, for the wind, depends on wind velocity and two properties of the full bed. And for slope, depends on the slope and also a property of the full bed. So it is a deterministic model, and it assumes that there is a unique value for the rate of spread. And there are many, results in the literature where you can see, for example, for slope, that the rate of spread increases with slope. For downslope, it is practically constant. It doesn't change very much. For wind, the same thing. For contrary wind, it's practically constant, but for positive wind, the rate of spread increases very much. Actually, these are results from my laboratory, and for many years, we deal with this. But what happens is that, for example, if you have wind, if we have a situation in which the ambient wind is this one, and the fire front, the flame front is this, flame will induce a flow in the vicinity, and this flow will bring more oxygen to the reaction zone, and more fuel will burn, and so the fire front will, its size will increase. This added value of the induced flow will modify the ambient wind, and it will take that value. And what happens is that this process will go and along and along. So this flame will induce more wind, and it will grow and so on. For example, for a point ignition fire in a slope of 30 degrees, we can see that the head fire is constantly growing, and we find results like this. This is for point ignition in a slope. If we measure carefully the rate of spread of the head fire, we find that for steep slopes, at the beginning of the experiment, the rate of spread is this one, in the middle is that, and at the end is that one. So there are different values of the rate of spread for the same boundary conditions. The full bed is the same, the topography is the same, and there is no wind in this case, this situation. This explains why there is a great discrepancy in the results from different authors. Because if one author makes his experiment in a short table, he'll find lower values. If he makes in a longer, he'll find tend to find an average higher value. So this is even more noticeable if we have this concave shape like a canyon, and the results for a particular configuration are shown here, in which at the beginning of the experiment the rate of spread is very low, then it starts growing, and at the end it ends like that. So again, this is a let's say observation that there is not a unique value for the rate of spread of wind-driven fire. So the spread of a fire is a dynamic process, and I'll come back to this later on. Let's look at the general problem. If there is a wind or slope that is not parallel to the rate of spread, as you know, the rate of spread vector is always perpendicular to the fire front, and you can have, let's say, wind or slope that makes an angle with the fire front. This is very common in the field. So typically, you have here one situation in which you have slope, and the rate of spread, the fire front is like this. I'd like to ask you, do you have any opinion which one of these vectors will be larger, or will they be the same? Have any opinion? So this point is higher, this is the horizontal line, this point is higher. That one. Who thinks that the R2 is bigger, or who thinks they are both equal, or R1 is bigger? Shall we make a vote? R2 is bigger. Why? No, but let's see who is with this voting. R2 bigger? No, there are two others. Three. Okay. Who thinks? Pardon? Okay. Who thinks they are both equal? The same. Pardon? They are both the same. No voting for the same. So I assume the others assume that R1 is will be bigger than R2. Okay? No opinion. Okay. No opinion. Why did you say that R2 is bigger? You're right, yes. R2 will be bigger. But if you apply the previous model, here the slope is the same for at all points, the full bed is the same, so the rate of spread should be the same. But what happens is that, indeed, R2 is bigger. And so the fire front, in its movement, it has a translation, but it has also a rotation. And this can be observed very clearly in the laboratory experiments like this, in a table in which we started a linear ignition. The table is inclined 40 degrees in the horizontal, and this line is making 10 degrees with the horizontal as well. And although the ignition was instantaneous, you can see that immediately there is more heat going to the top, and so the reaction is more intense there, and the fire front starts like this. and it rotates, tending to become parallel to the slope gradient line. But the downslope fire goes parallel to itself. It doesn't have the same effect. This is a very simple and very basic situation, but apparently no one had studied it before we built this structure and we did these experiments. For example, this concept of fire line rotation that we introduced with these experiments explains how a point ignition fire that initially is a circle can become a shape like this one. Actually, this is a result of an algorithm that we applied. As you can see, the let's say the lines that are not regular are the experimental ones, and the blue ones are the numerical simulation using this concept. One important thing is that the shape of the fire front is not always the same. It's not homothetical. It changes with time. What this study has shown us is that the rate of spread, the concept of rate of spread, is not sufficient to describe the evolution of a fire front. The rate of spread is related to translation. But when the fire front translates and rotates, we need other concepts to deal with it. And also, we should consider the extension of the fire line. These are very common concepts for us mechanical engineers, because we deal with fluid mechanics and things like that. What happens with the complex problem when we have both wind and slope with arbitrary direction? This is represented here. So we have slope effect, wind effect. One obvious consideration is to sum the both effects. And actually, Rothermel did this in 83, although to my knowledge, he had made no experiments on this. He just intuitively thought this was the model, to sum both effects. And he considered that if there is wind and slope, the fire front will shape will be an ellipse or a double ellipse. And its max large axis will be the combination of both. And several models, mathematical models of fire spread, are based on this concept. One is the Huygens principle that was developed by Catchpole, and it considers that the fire line, each point is a point source and develops like an ellipse, and the union of the different points gives the fire location at the next time step. This is one example. In this case, there was a wind shift, and you can see the simulation. But and also there is a very well-known system, mathematical system, that is FastSight, that is available in the United States and elsewhere to predict fire behavior. But again, what we find is that the shape of the fire front is not exactly an ellipse, and again, it is changing. This is a point ignition fire with wind at different time steps. As you can see, the shape of the fire front is always evolving. So the consideration of an ellipse is just an approximation. But when we look at the combination of slope and wind that we can do in this test rig, in this case, wind is is blowing at 90 degrees to slope, the shape of the fire front is like this. And to my point of view, this is not an ellipse. It's not even a symmetrical shape. And it is not always the same shape. It is always evolving. If you look carefully at this fire perimeter, we can consider these four points. This is the line of slope, parallel to slope. This is parallel to wind. In this section of the fire front, the fire will evolve with favorable wind and upslope. And here it's contrary to wind and against slope. Here is with favorable wind but downslope, and here is against wind and upslope. So in each part of the, in each section of the fire front, there are different convective mechanisms, and all of them interact, and so we must have some continuous law around the fire perimeter, and the problem is not so simple as the concept of elliptical growth would suggest. This is a case that we are still studying. Finally, the eruptive fire behavior. We observe that fire in steep slopes and in canyons has a peculiar behavior that consists in a very rapid increase of the rate of spread, what we can call a fire eruption. In the American literature, this phenomenon is known as blow-up. But when we try to translate this to Latin-derived languages like Portuguese, there is not a good translation, because blow-up suggests that this is an explosion, and which is not correct in this case. What I'm talking about is like this. We have a fire that started somewhere here in this started or developed in this slope, and when it grows, it creates a very strong column. And I've seen some pictures in the posters outside about similar events. We studied this problem in the laboratory extensively, and also in numerical modeling, and so, because it's very much related to fire safety. Many accidents have occurred in situations like this. Many fatalities have occurred like in conditions like this one. These pictures are 20 seconds apart, all of them. What happens is that at the beginning the fire grows very slowly, and a firefighter team that reaches here thinks they can put out the fire very quickly, and they go around it, but suddenly fire makes this. The same 80 seconds, 20 seconds apart in each picture as in the previous ones. If we look at the advance of the fire front along this line of the head fire, we can see that the advance with time in some configuration is more or less regular, but in some others grows sort of exponentially. The derivative, that is the rate of spread, in some cases is practically constant, but in some others changes with time. So we, based on these experiments and also in field experiments, we tried to develop a mathematical model. How am I on time, Rick? 15? This is a semi-empirical model based on two assumptions, and takes into account the feedback between the fire and surrounding flow. I have seen that there are some posters outside that deal also with this problem. But what I would like to point out is that this model explains, in my opinion, in a very simple way, how the fire modifies itself. When we are used to those concepts that I've just described, that if you know the wind velocity, you have the rate of spread, you cannot explain how the rate of spread changes without any change of wind. But if you take into account that fire induces its own wind, then it comes back. So our first assumption is that there is unique relationship between the, for a given full bed, between the rate of spread and the wind velocity. This wind velocity is some reference wind near the fire front. It's an instantaneous value of the rate of the wind velocity. For example, we can obtain similar plots in the experiments. The second assumption is that this instantaneous wind velocity is a sum of the ambient wind with the wind induced by the fire. And this wind induced by the fire in the time step dt depends on the rate of spread of the fire front. This is consistent with the fact that for a given rate of spread, we have given the size of the fire front, of the flame, and so all the mechanisms of radiation and heat transfer are dependent on the size of the fire front. So this is the relationship. We can assume different shapes for that relationship. One very easy to consider is this power law. And if we combine both functions, we can solve, we can put a differential equation for the rate of spread as a function of time. This differential equation, if we integrate it in the given boundary conditions, we can look at the variation of the rate of spread with time. For this particular case, where we are considering this function for the rate of spread, we can solve this equation in order to the wind velocity. We can differentiate the that equation and have this one. And we can put this value there, and we can obtain a differential equation that does not have wind velocity explicitly. And that equation is this one. This is a differential equation that shows that the rate of spread changes with time whenever the rate of spread is different from one, this normalized rate of spread. This normalized rate of spread is equal to one on flat terrain without wind. So whenever we have wind or slope, this will be different from zero. When these exponents are equal to one, there is a very simple analytical solution for this equation. It's an exponential growth, and this actually happens in fires spreading along vertical walls. This is that solution. We use some normalization because we want to apply the experiments done in laboratory to other conditions, namely to field or real world conditions. I'm not going into details here. These are the parameters of the model. They can be essentially determined independently, and some are defined by the full bed properties and the initial conditions of the fire. Using some of the experiments, we determined the parameters, and then we checked the result with the other experiments, and that comparison is shown here. This curve is the integration of that differential equation. It was integrated numerically, and it shows that the rate of spread, this is for a given full bed, changes with time. If you have a given initial value, it will go grow, and reach those values. And this shows what I mentioned before, that the rate of spread can change with time as well. Just to conclude, we'll show you one particular case that I investigated 2 years ago. In 2003, it was a very bad fire year for Portugal. In one single year, we burned 400,000 hectares. That was more than four times what we normally have each year. And during that year, we lost 21 lives. And I went personally to the places where each one of these accidents occurred. And in one particular case, in which two persons were killed, this happened in this slope near the border with Spain. A fire started around this point, and firefighters were trying to put the fire out, putting it on the bottom of the slope against the river. They had almost managed to control the fire. There was only a very slight flame there, fire at 10 to 15 meters, but suddenly it erupted and blew and burned all this area, all this slope, in less than 30 minutes. And a couple that was here visiting a site that they had here was killed. This gives an impression. It was at the bottom of this canyon. At that point, there was a metro station. The fire, so as you can see, went from here up there. This slope, this picture was taken about 7 days after the accident. It was covered by shrubs about 3 to 4 meters high. They were all cleaned. If you look at the weather station, although it was not burned because it had rock around, but it was passed by the hot gases. And when I retrieved the data, the temperature went up from 30 or 40 degrees to 56 degrees in a period of 10 minutes. The wind that was blowing downslope shifted 180 degrees upslope. The wind velocity went from 15 kilometers per hour to about average 56 kilometers per hour, and the gust wind was around 96 kilometers per hour. So at this moment I'd like to ask you, anyone of you consider that it was a sudden atmospheric event that triggered change of the fire? Some heat wave that passed there that modified the temperature and wind? Or was it the fire that induced these records? What's your opinion? Was the fire that modified, or was the... Okay. But I can tell you there are still people that don't believe this. Of course. If we, our model can be used to compute the rate of spread, but there, as there is one-to-one relationship between rate of spread and wind, we, in this case, we used to compute the wind velocity because we didn't have the record of the rate of spread, and we compared with the measured data to find this thing. I don't have time to go into the details, but the parameters that I used for this calculation were the same that I used to, in the analysis of some other accidents that actually occurred in the United States that are very well reported. And I used one of them and for determining some of the parameters, and then I applied them to other cases. As you can see, it takes around 20 minutes, about 20 minutes for the fire to go into an eruption in a type of vegetation like this. If the vegetation is different type, for example, if it is grass, it takes less time. So, to conclude, I'd like to refer that I mentioned some related problems with the fire prediction, namely fire danger risk assessment, and to our opinion, it is very well described by the Canadian Fire Weather Index. So it's not... should not be, let's say, surprise for you that at least in Europe we are using it very, very strongly, not only for operations but mainly also for scientific work. It's our common language nowadays, the Canadian Fire Weather Index. Fine fuel moisture content is a very important parameter, and we advocate that it should be estimated with good accuracy. And I try to show you that the general problem of wind or slope induced fires is not yet solved, or at least cannot be solved assuming simple steady state conditions. I also try to show you that the concept of rate of spread is not sufficient to describe the movement of a fire front in general case. And I also try to show that in some conditions, the convective flow induced by the fire can accelerate its rate of spread, causing what I call an eruption. And this can occur particularly in steep slopes, in canyons, or in wind-driven fires.